Blog Talk Radio.
Juwanza, and welcome. We're so excited about the show that we are offering you tonight. We'll be talking about landlord-tenant rights, what you need to know, and we have a very, very special guest with us tonight, Elizabeth Godwin-Jones, with Godwin Jones and Price. She's an attorney and founder of Godwin Jones, and we are so excited that she has agreed to come on tonight and share with us some really good information about landlord-tenant rights.
This is going to be a fabulous show, and I just want to welcome all of the listeners. If you've been following us for a while, you know that we talk about all things real estate, whether you're an investor, whether you're a first-time home buyer. We talk to the experts, and tonight is no exception. We want you to be educated. And the best way that we can ensure that is that we get the educators. And so I'm very excited to have our special guest today. Can you tell us a little about her, Yvette?
Absolutely. Elizabeth Godwin-Jones, she graduated with honors from Iowa State University with a BA in German and was inducted in the Phi Beta Kappa. She earned her Juris Doctorate from Georgetown University, where she served on the editorial board of Law and Policy and International Business. She's a member of the Virginia State Bar, the Virginia Creditors Bar Association, the Central Virginia Apartment Association, and the Richmond Apartment Owners Association. And I can go on and on. You know, that in itself says a lot concerning, you know, the time and the education that our special guest has in being able to break down and also provide us with the information that we're looking for tonight concerning landlord and tenant rights.
With credentials like that, I think we're in good hands, don't you?
Absolutely. So. Beth, welcome to Health, Wealth, and Real Estate.
Well, thank you so much for that great introduction, Yvette and Juwanza, and thanks for sharing your platform with me tonight. I look forward to addressing some of the issues that your listeners have raised.
Oh, you are very welcome, and I definitely was anticipating and anxiously anticipating and waiting for this show. And so we're going to get started for those listeners that are listening tonight, and especially those that are interested in real estate investing, for even those that are currently renting, although you may be thinking about purchasing a home in the near future, you also, this show is for you as well, so that you can know some of the things that you may have questions concerning and you really didn't know who to ask, where to go to. So that's what Beth is here tonight for, to kind of answer some of those questions that you may have been wanting to ask. You can also, if you have a question, you know, just we could notify us, and we will bring you on the air so we can allow you to speak with Beth. So, Beth, we're going to get started. And one of the very first questions that that we would like to know is, what are the laws that are in place that currently apply to landlords and tenants? Some people may not know necessarily where to go to or what those laws are. So can you tell us a little bit about laws that's in place concerning governing the relationship between landlords and tenants?
Yeah, sure. That's a real basic information that you all should know. And I can just add to your reasons to listen tonight. Some of you might have children who are going off on their own, or friends who have gotten into a rental situation that's not working out well for them. There's a lot of times when it's good to know, if you don't know the answer, at least where to go to look it up. And that's one, another reason to know a little bit about landlord-tenant law. Before I answer that question, though, I just want to let you know that the information that I'm giving you today is based on my experiences generally, and I've been practicing landlord-tenant law since the 80s. The results are of all of every situation is different, and so what result and what outcome you can expect is going to be fact-specific. So I don't want this, you know, I'm not giving you any legal advice, on any particular situation, just the general trends and things to consider. And I also need to let you know that the whole world has been upended. My world, after all these years, is turned totally upside down by COVID. All the regular rules are standing upside down right now, and we've been inundated with changes in court procedures. Courts were closed for a while and not hearing any cases. Now they're getting back to normal for landlord-tenant cases, but still not 100%. There have been new legal requirements imposed on landlords for evictions, and we're going to talk about all of those things later. But the result of this dramatic change has been that there are no clear answers. I used to be able to tell you pretty generally what you could expect in this situation or that. But these days, everything is fact-specific. It's specific to the court that you're appearing in, and it's even specific to the judge in that court, because it's open to interpretation. The law that governs the landlord-tenant relationship had been in effect since the 80s. And so over all that time, a pretty steady interpretation had developed. It's not often appealed to appellate courts like the Virginia Supreme Court, but still there was you could pretty accurately predict the outcome of a particular situation. But now in the days of COVID, it's really difficult to tell. So lots of times I'm just taking my best guess. And so I do especially want to add a caveat to that. But to get to the question, the first question is a really, really good one. And the law that governs the landlord-tenant relationship is the Virginia Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. It's usually referred to as the VRLTA. And, in fact, if you want to find it in the Code of Virginia, the whole code is online. And if you just Google VRLTA, it'll take you right to it. So it's easy to find. It also is fairly easy to read and to interpret. There's a little bit of legal mumbo-jumbo in there, but for the most part, it's fairly straightforward and easy to understand. And this one law, that's a fairly recent change. There used to be one law that sort of governed smaller smaller owners with fewer properties, but effective into 2019, I believe it was, the Virginia residential part was totally split off from commercial. And now that act governs all residential tenancies, regardless of the number of properties that any particular owner has owns or has an interest in. So it is the go-to place.
Did you say that at one time that law was one law that governed the residential and commercial tenancy, but now you said it's separate?
Well, there was a little bit of overlap. It started out as just one law for any tenancy, and then in the 80s there was kind of a consumer push to provide more protections to tenants. There were some really egregious cases with landlords where courts had to go out on a limb a bit to carve out and create remedies to prevent susceptible tenants, usually lower-income tenants, from abuse at the hands of landlords who didn't keep the property up but still wanted to be paid the rent all the time. So there were very few options for tenants. Everything was geared more towards landlords. So that there developed a movement, a nationwide movement, to come up with a basic landlord and tenant law that would be geared towards residential tenancies only, and it would build in some consumer protections so that not only landlords had rights, but tenants had rights as well. And that was adopted in Virginia, I think it was 1985. It was sometime in the 80s. So it's a fairly new body of law. And at first you could opt out of that law. You could say, no, I want to stay in the vague one that doesn't give the tenant so much, so many rights. And you could do that automatically if you were under a few, I think the threshold was four tenants. It's been a while since I've looked that up. But then you could say, I don't want to be included. You could opt in if you wanted, but the default setting was that you were opted out. And if you were opted out, you were still in that sort of vague, it was unclear, right, what rules applied in that case. So I always encourage people to opt in because the VRLTA is pretty clear, and it provides a lot of guidance. So then gradually over time, those two acts within the general non-VRLTA part of the landlord-tenant portion of the Virginia Code, there was like a subcategory that mirrored the VRLTA but applied to those smaller owners. And so then eventually those two were merged, and that was carved out totally, and now it applies to all residential tenancies, and it has those consumer protections.
You mentioned VRLTA.
Go ahead.
So you mentioned LTA. Are the landlord-tenant laws state-specific? I know we're talking about, and just for the listeners, we're talking about Virginia, but are the landlord-tenant laws state-specific? Do they vary from state to state?
Yeah, they do, Juwan, so that's a good question. There's a commission that forms these model laws that could be implemented by states if they want to. And so every state, as they implement those, if they decide to do so, they can change them because that's just the framework, and then you can vary it according to, you know, what your traditions are. So ours is state-specific and would only apply to residential tenancies in Virginia.
Okay.
It also, there are a couple of things it doesn't apply to, like dorms, fraternities and sororities, campgrounds. If you don't pay any rent, that's not included. The tenant doesn't pay rent. If you are a landlord, a management company maybe, and you have an employee and you want the employee to live in on site so that they're available for emergencies, that doesn't come under the VRLTA. Some of you may have had a sale contract where the seller has the right to stay for a while, or the buyer moves in early. Any residency pursuant to a sales contract is not included. And then like nursing homes, and if you go to the doctor or the hospital and you stay for a while, those are not covered by this law either. But just the run-of-the-mill landlord and tenant, those are all covered. It doesn't matter how big or how many or how few properties you own. In some instances, there are some carve-outs within the VRLTA for smaller owners where they're kind of given a break on some of the normal requirements, and that's really been a growing trend during COVID because with COVID, these restrictions that have been added involve a lot of time and they're more likely to have a harmful effect on smaller owners who might not have the cushion that a larger portfolio would have. So, but that's all done within the VRLT itself. It say here are the rules if you have 1 to 4 properties, and if you have more than 4, then this is the rule for you within the same provision.
Okay. And so as it relates to the ethical compliance, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Several people had asked if there were any laws that specifically had a code of ethics for the landlord or the tenant. And we don't really have a separate code. The ethics that are implied in the VRLTA are that if you're going to be a landlord, you're going to know the law, you're going to follow it. And it's especially, assumed that the landlord is the one who is doing it as a business, that you're going to know the rules of the business that you're operating in this case being a landlord, and that you're going to follow those laws. And for the tenant too, there are rights and responsibilities for the landlord, and there are rights and responsibilities for the tenant. I really love it because it's kind of like reciprocal. If I have the right to evict you because you don't follow the lease, then you have the right to get out of the lease and get a release from the lease. And we both have to follow similar steps of giving a written notice and letting a cure time go by so that you don't just jump the gun. You go through this procedure where you basically talk about it. And I like the way the VRLTA reflects the fact that a landlord-tenant relationship is different in a way from most other contracts. Like if you have a doctor, you might love your doctor and you might never think of leaving that doctor. But if you have a disagreement with how your doctor is treating you, it's easy for you just to ask for your medical records and move on to another doctor. But if you think about the importance of your home, you've got all your belongings in your home. You've got furniture and possessions and pictures on the wall, and your kids go to school in that district. And so it's a more of a long-term relationship that's harder to rupture. And so the idea is that both parties are going to form a good relationship. It's a business relationship, but it's also based on doing what you're supposed to do on both sides. And if either side doesn't do what they're supposed to do, then the party who's harmed by that decision has an out. They have a remedy available to them. And they sort of mirror back and forth, the different things that a landlord can do, a tenant can do also, just in a different way.
Okay. This is great information, because often when I work with a client that is looking for a home to buy, I hear complaints. I actually hear complaints of, not just because I want to, the pride of ownership and to have my own property, but a lot of times I hear it's because the landlord is not keeping up with their responsibility concerning maintaining the property. And in many cases, tenants don't know or can afford an attorney to exercise their rights as far as making the landlord accountable for what the landlord is supposed to do. In that particular situation, if the tenant is not able to part of the reason definitely that we're providing this information today, but what is one of this what do you recommend in that particular case if the person feels, okay, I know I'm not in a position that I can hire an attorney, the landlord is not under a property management company, what would you say that person should do in that particular case?
Right. That's a great question. And in Virginia, the tenant has a remedy that's called a tenant's assertion. I guess lawyers have to use these weird words and instructions that no one else would use, but it's an assertion that there's a breach of the lease by the landlord, I guess. And to do that, you would need to give a written notice to your landlord telling them that you're having this problem, the heat doesn't work, or the water pressure is low and you can't take a shower, or whatever the problem is, that should be something that the landlord would correct. You give them a written notice. I mean, of course, you'd probably want to just call first and see if you can work it out that way, but if you don't get any results, the law requires that you do give a written notice and that you give a reasonable time for the landlord to cure the problem. And reasonable is generally 30 days. Again, it's fact-specific, because if you're not having any heat and it's 20 degrees outside and you have little children, then 30 days might not be reasonable to wait for the heat to be restored. So it is fact-specific. But you then, after you, when your time, or I call it a cure period, when the landlord has the opportunity to cure the problem, once that time is over and it's been reasonable, it's not just I'm going to let you know today and then I'm going to file this case tomorrow, you pay your rent into court. So you can withhold the rent in this circumstance where you feel that there's a breach of the lease by the landlord, but only to the extent that you pay it into court and you let the court rule on whether you're entitled to have part or all of that back. You don't do it unilaterally. You involve the court as the decider of the fact and what the outcome is going to be. And that gives you a pretty quick court date. Usually that rent would be paid the 1st through the 5th of the month, as it's due within the grace period, and then the case would be scheduled within 2 weeks usually, because it is entitled to priority on the court's docket. They do those quickly because those are issues that need to be resolved for the tenant's sake.
You know, Beth, I know that in D.C. there's a show that comes on the news. I don't know if they still do it. It was called Seven on Your Side. You might be familiar with that. I don't know. They probably have the equivalent down here in Virginia, and it wasn't uncommon to see situations where you might have a landlord-tenant situation where the tenant might have contacted the news agency to, you know, shed light and bring awareness to this particular problem. It could be mold in the bathroom, mm-hmm. or, you know, situations where the heat wasn't working, just all kinds of stuff like that. Is it safe to assume then that if they have gone to, say, one of those like news agents, like Seven on Your Side or something, that mm-hmm. all of these other remedies were not followed? I mean, because it seems like they would have followed that and gotten something, some sort of answer to their, you know, some sort of remedy, either a yes, we're coming to fix it, or, you know, no, we're not coming to fix it. And if they promised to fix it and didn't fix it, the court seemed like they would have, you know, had some legal remedy available to them. Is it safe to say that if by the time it goes to one of these news programs, that none of those other options work?
Well, that's a good question. We have around Richmond is 12 on Your Side, so it's kind of the same same franchise. I can think of two explanations for that. One is that you do have this cure period, so you have to give the notice and give the landlord a chance to correct it. And maybe during that period, the tenant is trying to put a little more pressure on the landlord to take care of it. The other thing is, well, I guess I can think of three things, and the second one is that the tenants just aren't familiar with that unless you've specifically looked into it. I don't know how. There's a lot of information out there, the Virginia Legal Aid and a lot of the legal aid societies have websites that have questions and answers and information sheets that you can download. I don't know if people just don't know to look for that and don't know about it. That's another possibility, I guess. And it could be just. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think actually they don't know. And again, that's a part of the reason why, you know, we wanted to bring this broadcast because, as I mentioned, I hear these type of complaints, and some people just, you know, after complaining a while, they just decide, you know, I'm just going to, I know from the situations that I've experienced that, you know, my clients have said, you know, I just couldn't take it anymore, and I just didn't want to renew my lease, and because I think it's an issue about being concerned as well, not to jeopardize that credit. They don't want to mess up that credit, so they just kind of, and these, I'm referring probably to smaller, you know, single family residential properties where it's a person that, you know, the landlord is not under a property management company, so, but this is so I would imagine that if they don't know about the court steps and they don't know, they will probably try to contact someone from the news to make the landlord comply or I guess advise them as well, especially if they can't afford an attorney. Mm-hmm. But this again, this is great information because. That's a part of what we want to stress today to our listeners that there are laws and guidelines in place, and yet there are steps that you need to take. But if that's a situation where you have to, make a drastic decision, and if you have to move, as you mentioned, that still go through the right procedures. You know, go to court. Have the court hold the, pay your rent to the court?
Right. They have an escrow account that you pay that into. That's right. And I would want to add, too, to that, Yvette, that it's very uncommon for tenants to have a lawyer when they file a tenant's assertion. That's the exception rather than the rule. And the courts are, you know, it's a much less formal proceeding for that kind of case, because they're just trying to solve the problem. They want to help the parties reach a resolution. So, you wouldn't have to have. All you have to do is pay your rent to the court instead of to your landlord. Give a notice, let a reasonable amount of time go by, pay the money into court, and then, you know, the landlord may or may not have a lawyer. But, you know, I've seen tenants get really good results, even, you know, when I've been involved too, because it depends on the case and the sympathy of the judge deciding the case and what steps have been taken by the landlord. So it's not required that you have a lawyer to do that.
Okay. You know, and so some of the things that we definitely want to also talk about is when it comes to a lease. So you have decided to lease a property, or the landlord is leasing out a property, and the tenant wants to lease the property from the landlord. Can you talk about the lease requirements in the state of Virginia? Is a written lease required? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's an interesting topic because it wasn't addressed at all in the VRLTA before. I think it was in last year's General Assembly session, the law was amended. It's not required that you have a written lease, but if you don't, the legislature wrote a lease for you. It's pretty short and sweet, but it's going to be for a year. That's the assumption is that any lease, like if you allow someone to move into a house that you own and pay you rent, the assumption is going to be that you're going to let them stay for a year. And there it used to be it was just a at will or a month-to-month kind of tenancy. You could terminate it any time. But now with this, you've had a year imposed on you by the General Assembly, and that was felt to be a good thing to give people some stability in their uncertainty in their housing situation. Now, it's not required that you have a lease. That's the default setting if you don't. It's still better to have a written lease, I think, because, as I had mentioned, the details that are spelled out in this written for you lease by the General Assembly are not real elaborate. And you probably would want to have additional things in your lease that aren't covered by this. And it's also possible that you, or as a owner or the tenant, don't want it to be a year. And in that case, you would need to have something written up to choose a shorter period of time. It could be someone is studying at VCU for one semester, only needs to rent for, has one semester left and just wants to stay for one semester and doesn't want to get into a year-long commitment. So you can still do that, but you have to do that in writing to get out of this requirement of the year lease. Now, some of the questions people had submitted to you in advance involved what about this and what about that. And aside from these general requirements of a lease, if you don't have something to the contrary, there aren't a lot of things spelled out in the VRLTA, because it is a contract. It's a specific type of contract between two parties. So you can negotiate a lot of things like what happens at the end of the lease. Is it going to auto-renew on a month-to-month basis? Is it going to auto-renew for a year if you don't give 60 days notice? All of those details can be included. What's the late fee? When is the late fee due? Let's see, what utilities are provided? There's so many details that you might want to spell out, and so it is good to have a basic lease that you can use. I really recommend that you have one. There used to be one that a lot of people used that I think they got at the office supply store. They had a general lease available. Of course, if you're working with a realtor, then you've got a great lease. The Virginia Association of Realtors has a really good one that spells a lot of things out and gives you choices. You can check this box or that box and have certain things apply. So that's a good one if you're working with a realtor.
What about rooming houses for a quick second? There may be people out there that are either living in rooming houses or somebody that might be renting rooms. Still, same suggestions. You definitely need a lease for something like that, and same laws apply to the tenant still in terms of, notice. In terms of notice to vacate a property or something. I mean, you still have to have X amount of days prior to leaving. And again, when it comes to the upkeep and maintenance of the property, the same laws apply as would in a normal rental.
Well, you can sometimes, like particularly in student housing, you rent a room and then the use of the common area. The biggest thing I would worry about in a rooming house situation is the zoning, because that's a big warning sign, I guess. I don't work with too many people in that situation. It's more common that maybe there's one a roommate rents out, an owner, a couple divorces, and one party ends up with the house and rents, a room and the use of the rest of the house to somebody else. A rooming house is, I think, you really would have to check with the zoning to see if that would be allowed in that particular area, because there's often limits on how many people can live, unrelated people can live in the same house.
If
it is illegal, then then the same rules would apply. You'd just say bedroom one, bedroom two, bedroom three. You'd want to have them numbered, and individual locks and access to the main door. And so then your lease would say that you're leasing bedroom one and the use of the common area.
Okay.
Okay, and I mean, great information.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the screening process, so landlords, I would imagine, would want to take their, you know, the prospect tenant to, you know, through certain, you know, screening processes. So what would you recommend is a good screening process or screening procedures for landlords?
Right. Well, I there are a lot of companies that provide that those services. They would screen for credit, and they would screen for criminal background, do a criminal background check. And so I don't, unfortunately, since I don't work with that end of it at all, I don't know any, I don't know any specifically to say use this or don't use that. But I know there are a lot of companies out there that provide those services, and those are things that you'd really want to check out very carefully before you let someone in. That's a big mistake that's frequently made, is not vetting a prospective tenant sufficiently. We have people pop up going from this place to that place, and they're bad apples wherever they go. And in fact, I had the very first landlords that I ever worked with was a Hungarian couple that did everything themselves, and they did their own screening. I'm not sure how they did it. I think they just had you fill out an application. And one of their tenants became very far behind, and I filed an unlawful detainer for them. And when on the court date, of course, back then you went right up to the bench, right next to the judge. Right now they have barriers keeping you farther apart. Back in the day, you could go up and stand right next to the judge, and the judge in that case looked down at the name, and he kind of said under his breath to me, "Good gosh, didn't they screen this at all?" Because that guy was so well known in that particular court. He'd bounced from one landlord to another that even the judge could have provided good screening information had they asked the judge before rather than after. So it's really, really important to vet people. And there are a lot of con artists out there, I guess. That's my caveat. There are a lot of people who are, they're pros at getting into a place. They seek out small owners who don't have a management company, and then they give a song and a dance and get in, and then they just don't pay any rent at all, and they're hard to get rid of because they've done it often enough that they know exactly what to say and when to say it to buy themselves some more time. And then when the gig is up, they'll move, and you won't be able to collect any of that rent. So it's really so crucial that you do that first. And in addition, you should also have a written selection criteria that you can share with your applicants, because you want to be upfront about what your requirements are. You want the applicant to self-determine that he's not going to qualify and just say, "Okay, thanks, I'll take this and get back to you later," if the tenant, the applicant knows that they're not ever going to meet your screening criteria. So that should be something that you apply to everybody. That gives you the protection of not discriminating against some people. And your application form should have things like a social security number. You should always have a social security number. That drives everything these days. We have to screen people for whether they're in the military or not, and that's done by a database run by the Department of Defense, and you access that information by the Social Security number, and that's a requirement now because military members are entitled to special protections. So you really have to have the Social Security number. You need employment information, and I suggest you get the last four pay stubs so that you know who the company is, because they might say, for instance, "I work for Philip Morris." Well, Philip Morris is huge, and they have a lot of of vendors, of people that they work with that provide services strictly on their campus. So they might, it might be true that they work for Philip Morris, but they're not paid by Philip. They work at Philip Morris and their facility, but they're not paid by Philip Morris. So it's important to see who's actually issuing that paycheck. And you want to verify with the prior landlord their rental history and see if they're in good standing then with that. And for that, you're going to need a written application that authorizes you to obtain information from these outside sources.
That's what that question mm-hmm. that I was about to ask, because you're asking for a Social Security number, and some people are a little leery about providing that Social Security number, but, you know, if you're actually going through a property management company, I would assume that people feel more comfortable going through a property management company. But when you are applying, you know, with a, you know, a smaller landlord, a single family home, those what's in place to, I guess, protect people concerning, you know, off giving their Social Security number and this information. So I would assume that the tenant also has to make sure that all this person is legitimate and this is the owner of the property. Mm-hmm. Have you ran into situations where that was, you know, someone actually thought that this person was the owner and it actually wasn't the owner of the property and the person wasn't given permission to actually lease out the property?
Yeah, I've heard of that, especially I've heard I've never had a case of that myself, but I've heard of scams with people listing houses on, like, Craigslist, and they get the application and the the deposit, and then it turns out that they, you know, that here's your lease, come and pick up the keys, and they're not affiliated with that property at all. I've heard of that happening. So you can check the land records if you're working with an individual. You can check the land records of the city or county the property is in to make sure that you're dealing with the real person that you should be.
That is public information.
That is. The owner's name and address is public information. Most of the time you can access it online. There are a few stubborn counties, Henrico is one, that they absolutely will not make that available online, but you can call the Treasury Department and they'll tell you who that is. They're required to tell you that.
Okay. All right. What about the, can the landlord rent to anyone that he or she wants to rent to? Is there something in place? What are the guidelines concerning that? You know, years ago, we hear of cases of discrimination and different things like that. So what is the landlord, what rights do the landlord have when it comes to who they want to rent to, who they don't want to rent to?
Right. Well, again, that's why you need to have your written selection criteria to give you a safe harbor. So you set out what you want, and then, you know, then as long as you have this standards that you want your applicants to meet if they want to rent. But we do have a Fair Housing Act in Virginia, and so you're not allowed to discriminate against these protected classes. I typed them up so that I could reel them off and not forget one. Race, color, religion, national origin, sex, elderliness, source of funds, familial status, sexual orientation, gender identity, or status as a veteran. Source of funds is a new one that was just added last year, and that means that now I think there's a threshold of 4 units. You have to, if you have more than 4 units, you're required to accept housing choice vouchers now, and that's a much longer process. The unit has to be inspected and passed off by the voucher holder, and then you know, they run the numbers and they'll tell you how much the voucher will pay if it's approved.
Okay.
Let's see. Now, suppose the voucher is going to pay $750 and the rent is $1,000. When this bill was introduced in the General Assembly last year, the proponent assured the representatives, the landlord representatives, that nothing would change. You couldn't discriminate either way, in a good way or a bad way. You had to treat everybody the same. So if you're which we either assumed or were told meant if your criteria said your household income has to be, as part of your written selection criteria, you have to have three times the amount of the rent available as income, we were assured that nothing would change with that. You get the voucher amount and you count that as a source of income. And in fact, it specifically says source of funds. It doesn't say source of income because funds are any funds that you have available to meet your requirements in the month. But recently, the Housing Board came out with an interpretation, and it's been finalized now, that says you are only allowed to allow that multiplier to the tenant portion of the rent, not the total amount of the rent. So now you can only require that the tenant have funds, in our example, of three times the $250 that they're paying, or $750. So that's we in the industry thought that was discrimination in favor of the tenant, because now that tenant only has to have the $1,000 and $500 extra. You know, the $1,000 and then $250 of that multiplied by three would be a total of $1,500. Whereas if you came on off the street and didn't have a voucher, you would have to have $3,000. But regardless, they finalized that, so that's the rule now. If you do accept a voucher, you can only require that the tenant provide documentation of funds three times, or whatever your multiplier is, you know, whatever criteria you have, that has to be based on the tenant portion of the rent rather than the total amount of the rent.
Okay.
In the event of protected class, in the example of protected classes, does the advantage go to the protected class in a situation where all other things are equal? So let's say, for example, and I just use this as an example, okay, you take somebody, a couple, okay,
right,
a straight couple and a gay couple, all
right,
other things being equal, you know, they've been on the job the same amount of time, they make the same amount of money, I mean, everything else is equal. And let's say, for example, the landlord just says, okay, not because of any, you know, particular leaning on his behalf or her behalf, he just, you know, chooses the straight couple. Now, the gay couple could assume, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, they were discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and of course, they don't know that, you know, the landlord, that the other person, they don't know who actually got the property, who got the housing or whatever. But could a situation like that benefit the protected class, the couple or person in the protected class, because if all other things are equal, would then the onus be on the landlord to prove, if it was investigated, why they chose who they chose?
Yeah, that's a great question, Javonta. Certainly, if you, a straight couple is not a protected class, so if you decline the straight couple, you don't have that issue. Whereas you might if it were a gay couple. That would assume that they knew who all the other applicants were. But you're certainly opening yourself up to that. Again, I usually try to refer fair housing questions to another woman who works exclusively in that area, because the fair housing board has it's hard to find what their decisions are. It's not like if you go to the Supreme Court of Virginia, those are all published. All those opinions are published opinions. But the Fair Housing Board, my understanding, doesn't necessarily operate in that way. So it's not like you can see a trends going, you know, one way or another. So I like to refer to people who are practicing that kind of work almost exclusively mm-hmm. all the time and defer to their expertise in that area.
I do understand, but if a person suspects that they have been discriminated against, then they need to report that.
Right, that's right.
Where do you know exactly where would you go to report that, Beth?
I'd start at the Fair Housing Board, but again, I've never worked in that area, so that's just a guess that they would be the ones to start. That at least they could tell you how to do it. I think they would be mm-hmm. the starting. That's where I would start, if it were me.
Okay.
Or someone that I knew, a friend of mine.
Okay. And so
yeah,
I'm sorry,
I don't have more information on that. It's a really important topic, but I've just tried to stick with the court work, the regular court work.
No,
sure.
That's not a problem at all, and you know, that information can be Googled as well,
mm-hmm.
and you know,
mm-hmm.
as far as where to go. But as far as the what was those the federal fair housing mm-hmm. guidelines, a protected class, and versus the state that you shared?
The ones I shared were the state.
That's
the state. That's Virginia. Yeah, I should have looked up the federal ones. They overlap quite a bit, but I don't think they line up exactly. Virginia has more than the federal government does. And so there's a couple. Status as a veteran was added last year. Gender
mm-hmm.
identity and sexual orientation, I believe, were added last year. So so that's, you know, and the source of funds also was added last year. So,
I'm sure that it covers more in more detail some of those protective classes versus the federal. But as you mentioned, yes, for the listeners, and that's per state. I mean, because I know D.C. and Maryland, they have some additional classes that the Virginia may not cover.
That's right.
But yeah, this is information good to know, because you want to know your rights, and the landlords wants to know, should know, you know, I don't want to violate, you know, someone else's, you know, especially when it comes to fair housing, because those are fines. It could actually probably lead to, you know, just possibly jail time or whatever it could be. Yeah.
So if a person just, you know, comes in, the applicant comes in, and they just work in a tattoo parlor, and they've got tattoos on their neck, you know, their face, everything, and the landlord's like, oh, no. No, no, no.
Well,
no,
maybe
no,
that'll,
no.
Juwanza, maybe that'll be in the next legislative assembly next year, but I don't think it's come up so far, tattoos being
right.
a protected class. But if you want to look those up, too, you can just Google Virginia Fair Housing Law, and that'll, Mr. Google, good old Mr. Google, what would we do without him? He'll take you right to it.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Now, we talked about the landlord as far as, you know, questions or, the you know, questions that the landlord should, when looking for a tenant, the procedures and different things that a landlord should look for, what are some of the things that a tenant should look for when interviewing a potential landlord?
Yeah, that's a good question, especially if you're working with an individual. I think it's really important to vet the landlord, too. So I think you can get a lot of information just by talking to the landlord, just what kind of vibe do you get from him or her. You can talk to talk to the landlord just to draw them out to get a feel for their reaction by asking about their experience, how many units do you have, how long have you been doing it, what made you start getting into this business, you know, just to get a feel for their for what type of person they are. You could also ask if they have current tenants or former tenants that you could speak with about that. I don't know if tenant applicants ever do that or not, but that's, you know, you'd ask for a reference of the landlord, so to speak.
Landlord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then also you can check the court website, which is courts.state.va.us, and there's a case information system there. So you can look up the name of the landlord by general district court. That's the court that unlawful detainers are held in. And then you choose the court, general district courts, and then within that there's a menu that drops down and you choose the city or county that the property is located in. And then there's a name search. So you could search by the name of the individual or the entity that the landlord operates under, and see how many cases pop up. You know, that tells you, and do they sue, does that person sue the same person multiple times, or there's even a place on that form, if you drill into the specific case, where you can see if a writ was processed to have the tenant evicted. So that might give you some kind of feel for the landlord. As a landlord, the enforcement of the law and how much flexibility they have. And again, you don't know all the facts behind all of those cases that you may or may not find, but still, you know, that does give you some indication. And then again, you know, I guess you'd potentially want to make sure that they own the property. I guess I didn't have that on other things, but. But it's good to know that you're dealing with the right person.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm sure that's probably a serious scam out there. I'm sure that there are probably people that have given money to, not just money, but their personal information, like Social Security
That's
numbers
true.
And so forth, the wrong person, and, you know, just really regretted it.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, you know what, I want to ask a question that I'm sure everybody has heard this term and probably just assume they know what it means, but just for, you know, technical purposes, so people can know that they know that they know, what is a security deposit and how much can be requested? Everybody's heard that term, and I don't know if everybody really understands it. What's a security deposit?
Yeah. Okay, so the definition in the VRLTA is any refundable deposit of money that is furnished by a tenant to a landlord to secure the performance of the terms and conditions of a rental agreement as a security for damages to the leased premises or as a pet deposit. And so that it is extra money that's paid to be held against the faithful performance of the lease, which requires that you return the property at the end of the lease in the same condition that you got it, except for what you'd consider normal wear and tear. Like a brand new carpet isn't going to look brand new a year from now, but it also shouldn't look like it's a 9-year-old carpet either. So that's what the security deposit is for, to provide a source of funds for any damages above normal wear and tear that might come up during the term of the tenancy. And the most that can be considered is 2 months' rent.
Mm-hmm.
Most people only require 1 month rent or even less, because it is an owner might want to get you into the property, and having a large security deposit might be a problem. If you have good credit, then maybe they would let you go in on less than a month rent. So it's not required that you have any amount. It's just that there's a maximum of 2 months rent. And just to sort of procedurally take care of that, you're required to have a move-in inspection before the tenant moves in, and that can be just a sheet that you that the owner gives to the tenant and says, you know, there's no problems here. You take this back and you have 5 days, and after 5 days, if you don't turn it back with problems that you've noticed, I'll assume that everything's okay. So that's it can either be a walkthrough, a physical walkthrough at the time and the forms given to the tenant, or it can be something that's provided for them to complete and fill out. And then at the end of the lease term, within 72 hours, there has to be a follow-up inspection, and the tenant has the right to be present at that second inspection, where the landlord compares the condition at the move-out to what it was when it was turned over before the lease started. And within 45 days, the owner has to either return all of the security deposit or send an itemization of the charges that were withheld and a check for any balance that's due, or, you know, notice that they might owe in addition. You'd want to...
Did you say that it was for the tenant to attend the inspection, that final inspection?
It's not required, but the tenant absolutely has the right to be there. And the owner is required to give notice of the fact. Once, say, the tenant turns in a notice that they're not going to renew the lease, at that point you're required to send them a letter that says the walkthrough will be held within 72 hours. If you want to be present, please send me a written notice that you want to be present. And they absolutely have the right to be there. And any tenant should want to be there, too, to do that walkthrough. And mm-hmm. probably take a lot of pictures before you move out also to document the condition.
It sounds like that first walkthrough is just as important as the final walkthrough, and a lot of people probably don't even consider just how important that first walkthrough is, because that's going to really determine, when you're going through the final walkthrough, you have something to weigh it against. I mean, except as opposed to just weighing it against your memory,
you have something.
And
you do have to return it to the landlord too, within that mm-hmm. I believe it's 5 day period that you have. So you want to make sure that you give it back, and lots of times they'll be on a carbonated form, so you tear one off and keep the other. But you want to keep a copy for yourself and turn it into the landlord within that time frame. And then hopefully the landlord would fix anything that you found that's broken so that it wouldn't be an issue at move out that would have been taken care of.
Is the landlord required to hold those funds in an escrow account?
Well, that's really an interesting question. Surprisingly not. If there's a realtor involved, then the Board of Realtors does require that the security deposit be held in a separate escrow fund. But I don't know why that's never come up. But there's not a requirement that it be held in separate funds either. But
okay.
if you were going to be a landlord, I'd certainly think you'd want to keep them separate in some, because it's a longer term thing, something that maybe carried a little interest. And so that you have it separate and working for you, maybe not very much these days, but at least it's separate so that you're not mixing that in with your operating funds. It certainly is a better practice to do that, but it's not technically required unless you're a realtor.
That is interesting.
Yeah, I know. It's shocking, right?
because people have a tendency to, they might just get, sticky fingers or whatever, say, okay, I'll just take this and I'll put it back. It's a, I've got time, so.
That's right. Even with good intentions, perhaps, but that can happen.
What remedies are in place if a person, the landlord, I guess, doesn't return the full security? Well, most of the time they're not going to probably return the full security amount, but the person, the tenant, is questioning what the landlord has said, it has itemized, I guess, concerning the deductions for the difference that they have didn't return to the tenant.
Right. Well, the first thing you could do would be to try to work it out with the landlord, and give pictures, provide pictures if you have pictures of things that don't match up. And if you can't reach a resolution, then you can sue the landlord for the difference, and you can do that in small claims court probably yourself, because the jurisdictional limit is $5,000, and you don't have to have a lawyer, and it's a relaxed proceeding. It's not the normal rules of evidence don't apply. That would be one option, to sue in a small claims court. You could also hire a lawyer, because that's one instance where you can collect attorney's fees if the court rules against the landlord. The court can award attorney's fees to the plaintiff, too. So you could do that as well.
Beth, you mentioned something about hazard insurance policy. I mean, I see that was something that, you were talking, or you addressed. Hazard insurance policy alternative? Can you talk about that?
There is an option for you, for some landlords. I think this is more common in apartment complexes, that they'll have a work with an insurance company. And the advantage that the reason landlords like it is that you pay maybe $99 for a bond, That's a weird thing. I'm not really a great fan, because you as a tenant, I don't feel you get into the apartment with a smaller amount than a security deposit, but you don't get any of that back, and it doesn't provide you any insurance yourself. It's just the owner who benefits from that. So some companies do use that, and that's an alternative to security deposit. You can't generally have both. That's more likely to be used in an apartment complex, I think, than for an individual owner. And you should have renter's insurance. If you're renting, you should have renter's insurance, because the landlord is not responsible for damage to your personal property. So you'd want to have renter's insurance. It's relatively inexpensive, because it's only about your stuff. And insurance company, you can get that through an insurance agent. The landlord might have, it's possible for the landlord to require that you have that, and they can have a company that they work with. So you wouldn't have to get it yourself. They would get that, and then you're billed on a monthly basis for the monthly amount of it. But that's a good thing to have, the renter's insurance policy, because in case of a water damage or a kitchen fire, that would be covered by your renter's insurance.
Okay.
You know, in everybody's tendency, at some point a situation may arise where the landlord needs to gain access to the property, not, for the sake of eviction or anything like that. It could be to install fire alarms or something like that, smoke alarms, I meant. So in situations like that, how much notice is required that a landlord give to the tenant in the event they need to gain access for something like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, there's reciprocal rights and responsibilities, sort of the flip side of each other. So the landlord can't be abusive or coercive or be dropping in all the time, I want to check this, I want to check that, just to, that there are some of those landlords that are a little bit too curious, because it's supposed to be your right to stay there by yourself, not with the landlord constantly dropping in on you. But also, a tenant can't just willfully deny access for a legitimate cause by the landlord. This is sort of a good faith process, though, because the remedy is to go to court and ask for an injunction or the right to access, that the court allow you access, and that's kind of a drastic solution. So there's a lot of good faith assumed in this access issue. As far as maintenance requests, if the tenant reported a maintenance problem, then no notice is required. The landlord is free to go in to fix that, address that problem. Because they're required to maintain the property, and if the tenant says, hey, there's something that needs to be fixed, then it only makes sense that the landlord has the right to go in and fix it. And another time when there's no notice required is an emergency. If there's a water coming out from under the door, no permission is required. You can just go on in and turn it off. Or some other, you know, smoke coming out the windows, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The landlord always has the right to go in and address the emergency. And then the only other requirement that's hardwired into the code is if you're going to apply any pesticides, you have to provide 48 hours of notice. And the tenant has the right to say no within 24 hours, like that's not a good time or you know, for whatever reasonable pushback they want to give. But 48 hours for pesticides on the landlord's side. And other than that, it's just reasonable. Like suppose the landlord wants to go in and change the furnace filters or do some other kind of routine maintenance. They just have to give reasonable notice, and that's usually, you know, 3 days or 2 to 3 days, something like that. It's not spelled out what reasonable is, and it just sort of depends.
Okay. Well, Beth, a very, I guess, because of COVID and a lot of the different, I guess, procedures in place now concerning handling evictions and various moratoriums that are in place, what currently is in place and how is, I know you mentioned earlier things have all kind of changed a little bit, but what can you share with our listeners that's currently in place that that landlords and tenants should know concerning moratoriums?
Right. Well, we've had really three moratoriums. I'm not sure if it's moratoria or moratorium, so forgive me if I'm using the wrong Latin ending here. But there was the CARES Act moratorium that was went into effect last March, and it lasted through August. It was a 120-day moratorium. It applied to owners of who had a federally backed loan, and you couldn't file any cases against tenants during that 120-day period. Back then, in March, we all were thinking that by the end of 4 months, we'd be way past COVID, so you can see how overly optimistic we were in that score. Last fall sometime, I believe it was in October, the CDC entered an order authorizing tenants, if they met certain criteria, to submit a declaration to the landlord saying that they were unable to pay the rent, and then the landlord was unable to evict them. That's been challenged in several court cases. A court in Ohio and one in Texas ruled fairly recently that was unconstitutional. I think both of those cases are on appeal. There were at least two other cases. I know one in Georgia was filed in Georgia. It involved a Virginia landlord, but it was filed in Georgia because that's the headquarters for the CDC. And that one, I believe, went in favor of the CDC, but that's on appeal as well. So that's hardwired. If you're a landlord and you receive one of those CDC declarations, you can't evict. And gradually that's come to mean you can't actually put people out of the house. You can get a judgment, you can get an order of possession, but you can't actually evict the tenant until that expires, and right now it's effective through June, and I suspect it will be renewed again. So a tenant who's undergoing a hardship, COVID-related, has to be COVID-related, can provide one of those declarations to the landlord and not have to, not have to pay the rent. The rent is still due, it still accrues, and when the moratorium ends, it will become due, and the landlord will be able to file suit and evict, but your hands are tied in the meantime. Go ahead. What did you want to ask, Jawanza?
Just so in the event that the sheriff does come out and evict someone, and they're just presumably their, you know, items, belongings are thrown in the street, is there any responsibility of the landlord to, in any way, kind of protect the items that were just, you know, thrown out of his or her dwelling into the street or on the curb? I mean, is there anything in place that holds anyone responsible to ensure that, you know, because they are vandals. I mean, people run past the street, see your stuff sitting out there on the sidewalk, and, you know, there are people that will take it. I mean, is there anything in place that would cause anyone to be responsible for making sure that that doesn't happen?
No, there isn't. That's not anybody's, it's the tenant's problem. I will say, though, that, I mean, that's the only requirement is that if it's put on the street, the landlord can't remove it for 24 hours. So theoretically, the tenant could still get it within that 24-hour period. But I will tell you that an eviction out on the street rarely happens these days. The sheriff doesn't like to do them because they have to physically stay there while everything is moved out to the street. They don't do the moving. They just have to supervise it. So quite some time ago, the law was changed to allow a lockout eviction. So the locks are changed. And that's what almost everyone, that's done almost universally here in Virginia, at least the courts that I work in. It's just a fairer method for the tenant, because then the tenant really does have access for 24 hours to remove the rest of the belongings. Now, you don't get a copy of the key. The locks are changed, and the tenant wouldn't, you know, be able to get a copy of the key, but they can arrange to remove items during business hours for that 24-hour period. The landlord can't remove them during that 24-hour period.
Okay, well, Beth, thank you so much for the additional time that you've given us. I do have one more question.
Uh-huh.
And it relates back to the, I guess, what's currently in place concerning Virginia and eviction moratorium. So currently in Virginia, or is it, I don't know if it's based upon the city or is it based upon the state, are you saying that there is a moratorium still in place that if it's a situation where a tenant is not paying rent, is not in a lease, that they will have to follow the guidelines and the landlord will not be able to evict them?
Okay. Well, the first thing I should clarify on that CDC moratorium is it only applies if the tenant gives the declaration to the landlord. It's not a across-the-board moratorium, and that's a little bit misleading, I think, to call it a moratorium because it's not across the board. It's only
okay.
If you receive one. Now, as far as the Virginia law, Virginia does have laws that limit the landlord's right to evict, but they're much fairer. You're required now to give not a 5-day notice, as we've had all along in the many years that I practiced the landlord-tenant law, but a 14-day notice. So on the minute, the day that the rent is late, you would send a notice giving 14 days for the tenant to pay the rent. And in addition, you now have to provide, if you own more than 4 units, this is one of those laws that has a split between 1 to 4 and more than 4. If you own more than 4 units, you have to provide a payment plan option to the tenant that they have the right to break up the payments in up to 6 months or the rest of the term of the lease, whichever is less, so maximum of 6 months and potentially less. And then the third thing that you have to include in your notice of default, your 14-day notice, is information about the rent relief program that allows payment through money obtained from the relief bills from the federal government that was earmarked for housing relief. You can apply through a program that they have set up to have your rent paid if you've suffered a COVID-related loss. And a tenant can receive up to 15 months of rent paid through this program as long as the funding is available. And my understanding is that there's still a lot of money available. So the landlord is required to apply on behalf of the tenant or to cooperate with the tenant in applying, and the tenant is required to likewise to cooperate in applying. So that chokes down the landlord's ability quite a bit to evict. So we see very few evictions now because the rent relief program is paying out a lot of money. So if you know anyone who's a landlord with a tenant who hasn't been paying, that they should be hopping right on that and get the tenant to apply. And so if you go through those three options, the tenant signs a payment plan and doesn't keep it, the tenant applies for rent relief but for whatever reason is denied because they don't qualify and they don't pay in full, it is still possible to evict a tenant, but it's just a long, drawn-out procedure requiring usually quite a few continuances where we used to go file and then the first court date get the order of possession. It's stretched out over many months. We have cases that we filed last September that we're still working on. So they're going on a year now. So it's a lot slower. And if I could just answer one question that I think is one of the most important ones that was asked, submitted by your listeners. Is it advisable for a landlord to hire a property management company, and why? And I think this is the most important thing of all, definitely. If you're starting out, don't try to do it yourself. The saddest stories I've been involved with were individual landlords who maybe owned one or two properties. A lot of them couldn't sell their properties, and you had to move for whatever reason. And they were underwater in their loans around that last great recession that we had. And when you're working one-on-one with the tenant, it's just, and you don't know what to do if they don't pay. Who do you call? What do you do next? The tenant says, I can pay you at the end of the month. It's just all too easy to keep stretching that out over and over and over again. Before you know it, a landlord who really doesn't have any extra money available to work with a tenant is way underwater, and it's slow once you get to court. So definitely work with a property manager if you're starting out and you're not familiar with the procedure. It will be, they'll have all the forms, access to good vendors if you need a HVAC repair or a credit screening company. They're going to have all of that stuff available for you. You don't have to reinvent the wheel yourself. Try it a little bit and see how it works, and then if you want to venture out more on your own, at least you'll know what you're getting into, and you'll know what to do and what not to do. But I really strongly recommend that you work with a property manager, especially if you're just starting out as a landlord.
Wow.
Yes.
This has been an awesome, awesome show. Beth, we want to thank you so much for all of the powerful, pertinent information, usable information that you've shared. We told you, everybody, at the beginning of the show that we talk to the experts, and we keep our word, okay?
Thanks. I really enjoyed it, and I thank you for the opportunity.
It was our pleasure.
You're welcome. And, Beth, this information will be at about 30 minutes after the show. It will be archived. And, that's why we also have this information for our listeners as well, so they can share it with others and feel free to share it as well. And, of course, you can go back and listen.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, yes, definitely appreciate it. And this information is definitely vital information.
Yep.
And it's, and you actually, listeners, you are getting this from an attorney. This
yes.
is Beth does this. This is what she does, and this information is available now for you to be able to, know your rights and even to share with others and to help others. Again, Beth, thank you so much. Would you like to share some closing remarks?
Well, I just want to wish all of you luck. If you're a tenant, maybe just graduating from college or just leaving your parents' house and going out on your own, I wish you a lot of luck. And I hope you've gotten some tips that can help you find a good landlord. And if you're starting out as a landlord, best wishes to you. It's really, really an exciting prospect.
Well, thank you.
Thank you again,
everybody,
so much.
Don't try to remember everything that you heard tonight. Just copy and paste the link, share it with others, because, you know, this is a lot of information. And I guarantee you, let Beth speak for herself. Just share the link, and everybody, you'll be able to hear it. Again, we thank you. It's been an honor, and it's been a pleasure. Again, I don't want the show to end, but it's like, it got to go.
And we will post your contact information, Beth, so that the listeners can have that available to, if they have any other questions, would that be okay for someone to reach out and contact you?
Yeah, okay, that'd be fine.
Okay.
All right. Everybody, thank you so much for your time. Beth, again, we appreciate you and wish you nothing but the most success. Everybody, again, don't try to remember everything. Just share the link. This is where you hear from the experts. My name is Jawanza.
And this is Yvette.
Who are we? We're the ones who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Take care.